It's time for The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. The Local Take is all about community engagement, connecting our listeners with our community, and featuring people who don't always get media coverage, but who have important stories to tell. Now here's Kiplin Primus with The Local Take.
When you look at the blood, sweat, and tears struggle for African-American civil rights in this country, one of the signal victories was the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Last month, in the case of Shelby County versus Holder, the Supreme Court of the United States voted 5-4 to gut the heart of this nearly 50-year-old law, which called for federal approval before certain southern states could change the rules governing voting. Within hours of the law being struck down, several states reintroduced stringent ID laws regarding the ability to vote. Other red states rushed to enact restrictive voting rules that were previously under federal review under the Voting Rights Act. The Roberts Court basically decided the Voting Rights Act was so successful, it was no longer necessary. Kind of like the locks on your doors have kept out mayhem, so you no longer need them. What does this mean to our right to freely elect our representatives? What does this mean to the memory of those who died in the South to gain those rights? Today, we'll talk about it with Clark Atlanta University political science professor, Dr. William Boone. But first, we thought it was important to touch base with a direct link to those voting rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s. We're joined now by Bernice King, CEO of the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change. Good morning, Ms. King. Thanks for joining our conversation on the Voting Rights Act. What I wanted to ask you first, how do you think your parents would feel about the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I have to kind of frame my response in the context of two quotes by my parents. My father said, "Freedom is never freely given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." My mother said, "Struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation." I give those quotes because for both of my parents, they understood that we must always remain vigilant in every generation to ensure that rights are protected freedom continues to be advanced. I certainly think it would be a disappointment to them, but probably seen as a setback, but also an opportunity. I mean, we must never resign ourselves to believing that a ruling that may not be favorable is an ultimate setback. What will make it a setback is if we don't do everything within our power to ensure that the next level of this is addressed, and that is for the Congress to really go back and do the right thing to ensure that these rights are protected. That may or may not include a total restoration. It may be a further expansion. And so with my parents, you know, this, from a personal perspective, you can look at it as, wow, does this mean that all that they worked for all those years and the sacrifices they make, does that mean that this is, a setback, an insult, and perhaps it can be perceived that way and received that way. And people may feel like, you know, was all of that effort in vain? And I say no. I think they did their part. The question is whether we're going to do our part. And that's this whole thing of the torch being passed every generation. It's a freedom torch being passed and ensuring that we continue to fight for our freedom.
Well, that was actually the next question, because it doesn't seem that people are really talking about this. Do you think people are going to get involved and pressure Congress to do the right thing?
Well, I'm not sure where you're getting that from, but the people that I know have been talking about it. I mean, I've seen kind of stuff via blogs, social media, dialogue that people are having, and also with the upcoming 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, it will be front and central, along with jobs and other things. And so I don't think people are going to just sleep on this. I do think it is one of these moments to galvanize, you know, to be this generation's opportunity to contribute to the freedom struggle, because we are, you know, at the precipice of the possibility of this generation. And this generation can be means by age in terms of youth, what can mean this time period. We are, you know, on the precipice of possibly not contributing to the freedom struggle, or to making a great contribution. And this could perhaps be a blessing in disguise, galvanize, organize, and mobilize, and if nothing else, to wake up people to the fact that we cannot ever get comfortable because we have achieved a victory. That means we have to be fortified, and we have to continue to be watchful. We have to continue to work. We have to continue, more importantly, to build strong relationships in our world, because it really is a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And the more that we understand and value about each other and the respect and the dignity, the less we will have to depend on law.
It seems as if in the 50s and the 60s, the Supreme Court worked to advance the rights and privileges of minorities and women. It seems that this court has done almost the exact opposite.
I said that myself. I said the irony is that the Supreme Court was always the supporter of advancing the civil rights movement and representing the fact that the African American community, and here it's like there's a flip. There's been a switch, but again, you know, it's calling for something from amongst us. We have become very passive and complacent as a society, not just the African American community, but as a society. So we're deteriorating, you know, many of the virtues and the values that made us great from our founding are being, you know, taken away or being undermined. And it's only happening because we, the people, in order to form a more perfect union, are sleeping. You know, we're comfortable. We've allowed, you know, our material and scientific and technological abundance to outdistance our moral and ethical responsibility to each other. And so, again, these things happen when that kind of posture takes place. And therefore, yes, it is a travesty that, you know, the Supreme Court, that once was, you know, probably our staunchest supporter and advocate, seems to now be those who are undermining the progress. It's going to be very important how we handle this moment in time.
Well, Ms. King, I want to thank you so much for joining our conversation. We appreciate your time this morning, and time tells all. We'll see what happens.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Are we missing the widespread outrage here? Or do people just not care? If you're interested in fighting for voting rights in 2013, you can contact the National Action Network at nationalactionnetwork.net. Today, we'll talk about it with Clark Atlanta University political science professor, Dr. William Boone. How is it that we've ended up with this Supreme Court that is so severely conservative, I'll say, when it seems as if the rest of the country is much more progressive?
Yeah, that's a very good point. What is happening, this court is a court that was named dating back to the Reagan administration on through the two Bushes. And also you have a period of rising neoconservatism and conservatism in the country at the same time. And all these forces have come together. And everybody, the majority on the court now members of that Bush-Reagan kind of appointee class. And that's why you have it. Now, in the folk who are now coming up, the four, let's say, reliably liberal members of the court were appointed by more liberal people. You have at least two of them appointed by Obama, right? So, and Ginsburg, the woman, also an appointment that's more moderate to liberal. But it's a kind of cyclical kind of thing. It's a cyclical kind of thing. What you're going to get, the country certainly is moving in a more, let's say, less than right-wing way with the change in the demographics that are occurring all over the country. You're going to get changes. But that does not necessarily mean the court's going to change until somebody dies out or someone resigns.
Which is one of the things that I find slightly frustrating, because I remember, and I'm sure most people remember, getting the email saying, you know, Congress is going to overturn the Voting Rights Act. Call your congressman. You'd get it every time that the vote came up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I would always go, oh, that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. But it never crossed my mind that the Supreme Court would make a move like they did.
Yeah, you must remember, you know, in every presidential election, you get groups saying, look, you have to participate in the presidential election, because remember, it is the president who nominates individuals to be on the court. And of course, the Senate approves these nominations, but it begins with the president. That's why it's so important to elect a president that you believe will do something, will appoint members to not only the Supreme Court, but the circuit courts and the district courts. People who are moderate to liberal, or even progressive if need be. But the court is dangerous. The court is very dangerous, because remember, the court is the institution that is charged with the responsibility of interpreting the Constitution. Now, that may sound, oh, that's what has happened here is based upon everybody's baggage who sits on the court. And no matter how self-conscious they may be about how they feel and their biographies, it all comes to play.
But the court does not operate in a vacuum. And they had to know that by striking this down, that it was going to cause immediate changes, which it did.
Yeah, it did.
Texas, North Carolina, quite a few states, the laws that they had tried to get enacted before this vote, they immediately pulled them back up and tried to reinstitute them.
Immediately. I mean, you mentioned Texas. Within hours of the court's decision, the Texas folk put into operation that the very strict ID laws they had. You're absolutely right. I think what we need to talk about here is that here you have a court that is prepared to not deal in a real world, in a sense. I mean, when you read the opinion of the majority, it was written by Chief Justice Roberts. It's an opinion that says, well, they did a great job. There's no need for it any longer. And although admitting at the same time that indeed there are certain vestiges of this stuff left, but this kind of law is not needed. The Congress made a great error when it relied upon data that was outdated, et cetera. But the interesting thing about that is that in the four times that this thing has been reenacted, I mean, certain parts have been reenacted, each of those times, that particular formula has been used to incorporate new states each time, including New York, California, Texas, and other parts of the country, not just the original 7-11 states in the Confederacy.
In the South.
So they're really not dealing in the real world. They're dealing in a fantasy world. And I think if you look at Judge Ginsburg's dissent, you find all of that laid out for you. And the court's majority refused to acknowledge that. They are a states' rights court, very heavily states' rights, and a very conservative-leaning court. So you're going to get these decisions for quite a while.
It's just amazing to me that they made the decision, and it seemed like it was in this vacuum, and it was not going to have this impact that it's having. What it reminds me of is the Reconstruction period, when after emancipation, blacks were free. They had a chance to go out and make their way in the world. Some were elected to Congress, other offices. And then in the back rooms of power, they got together and said, this is too much. And they shut it down. And, you know, black folks and minorities were lost for another 150 years,
yeah,
practically.
Yeah, you're right. Reconstruction was an interesting period in America's history because it was kind of an ambivalent period. You did have a Reconstruction Congress at one point, ironically led by Republicans, who, for whatever motive, their motives were not exactly all just for the recently freed Africans, but certainly in the results of what we're interested in. And the results were fairly good for a short period of time during the Reconstruction period, but it was mixed. You always had heavy resistance in the South to this. And then once you got the historically speaking, once you had the compromise coming out of the election, and all the Southern the Union troops removed from the American South, then all hell broke loose. Everything reverted to what it was. In other words, a deal was cut, as you've indicated, that if you remove these troops, then we will be questioned on other questions. But you let us run the South as we have run prior to the Civil War, and that's what happened. So you get this. And you're absolutely right. And even during the 1930s and 40s, when you had the Depression, late 20s, early 30s, deals were cut that cut black sharecroppers out. So you're right. There's a cyclical kind of thing happening here.
Well, the cyclical thing is happening, but I think what people are forgetting, and again, this is operating in that vacuum, is that the demographics of this country are changing. And people who believe that America is only America for white citizens have got to change their mind or go.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, there are some states already, Texas, parts of California. Right, California, which are already showing the fact that European Americans are no longer the dominant group in the country. And it's happening here in Georgia, too, by the way.
So are European Americans saying to us, we will destroy this country rather than share it? Because that's what it kind of seems like sometimes.
Well, I think what you have is a fear that's being voiced by a very articulate and very powerful group. I'm not prepared to argue that the majority of whites in this country are such, but I am prepared to argue that you have people who are a very articulate and very powerful group who do want to maintain the status quo in a way they can. And one way of doing that, let me give a very, very basic kind of political thing. In the last redrawing of district lines across the country.
But gerrymandering is supposed to be illegal.
Right. Well, gerrymandering, drawing lines in a certain way is not quite illegal. It's illegal in a sense, you're right. And the Voting Rights Act certainly made it impossible to draw lines of dilute black vote or Latino vote or whatever. But now that you have this doing away with Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, it's possible now to go ahead and do those things, and those ill effects can occur. And it occurred a couple of years ago when they drew these lines again. So you're right. So what people, to get back to your question, what you have is this group that does run the country in a very interesting way through power, money, and influence and whatever, trying to consolidate their positions. And they're doing it.
But they're consolidating their positions on very shaky ground because the country has changed.
I'm not saying
the country is changing. The country has changed, and we still have leaders and people in power who are trying to put those same restrictions into place against blacks, Latinos, and women now, even if you look at some of the restrictions against women.
And young people, young whites, young blacks, young Latinos.
So how do the people in power think that they can actually hold on when everything has changed?
Well, things are changing, and things will change. I mean, I don't think they can hold the tab much longer. The recent immigration bill is a good example of that. The U.S. Senate has passed it. And I don't think the people, the Boehner and the members of that Tea Party caucus and other anti-immigrant groups in the House are going to maintain. I think the tide is pushing. It's pushing. And I think it's going to show up in terms of people like Mark Rubio, believe it or not, who finds himself caught in a very interesting kind of position. So you're absolutely right.
Well, I'm glad you said Mark Rubio and not Ted Cruz.
No. And I think even the Georgia Republican Party, although it is talking a good game, it's not making very many substantive changes, at least you have Deal talking about the fact they need to encourage more black and Latinos. But you're right. Why do they do it? You have to get inside their heads. Because they don't want to lose what they have.
But it's gone. I guess what I'm saying is gone. But the other thing I think that's kind of disappointing about this whole Voting Rights Act change is that it seems to have landed with a dud. I mean, it seemed like that day there were some people making noise and saying, right. this is crazy, what's going on? But it's been a couple of weeks now.
Not much activity.
We celebrated the 4th of July.
People went forward, no real discussions about it, right? I think
Texas introduced their, you know, all the states that wanted to introduce their crazy ID laws.
And those laws now are on their books, and they will probably sustain themselves at least through 2014 and probably 16.
You need more ID to vote than you need to buy a gun.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
That doesn't make sense.
In Texas, you can use your hunting license to vote, but you can't use your college ID. It is a very crazy kind of thing, which lets you know the kind of folk they're trying to appeal to.
But that's what I'm saying. It's as if in my lifetime, where people used to try to hide and cover and make it seem like we really do like you. It seems like that pretense is now gone, because not only don't we like you, we don't want you to vote. We're not going to make it easy for you to go to school, to live in our community.
Or even to get health care. I think you should mention also health care. All of these things are there. And I think since we're talking about the court in the larger context here, the court is a key instrument in doing that, because the rulings of the court, as we indicated earlier, are there for a lifetime almost, because until Congress, if Congress is willing to go back and change. It's interesting, in Roberts' majority opinion on the voting rights case, he talks about the fact that they gave the Congress fair warning. Now, this is interesting that an equal branch of government has the audacity to tell another branch of government what to do. Now, generally, in most courts, the courts will give deference to a legislative body's consideration and rulings. But here you get the court saying, heck no, this is not going to happen.
They actually penalized the Congress for voting almost 100% in right. favor of the law.
Absolutely right.
Which makes
their argument even more shaky, because any other time they would give deference. I mean, for instance, they're prepared to give deference to state laws, but not to federal laws. And the American Constitution does give deference and give superiority, quite frankly, to federal laws over state laws.
I just find this amazing. And the, you know, the Roberts Courts is responsible for Citizens United.
Yes.
Recognizing mm-hmm. corporations as human beings.
Right.
How does this go down in history? I mean, I know we've looked back at, you know, some courts, Plessy v. Ferguson and Good. You know, laws that were eventually overturned, and they've analyzed the judges and the backgrounds, and we've gotten all of this kind of trivia and, you know, everything you know about these judges and why they made these decisions. When people look back at the Roberts Court, what are they going to think?
If indeed you are conservative, you'll call them good times. but if you're more moderate and progressive, you'll probably go, this was not the good times for us. This was pre-1896, the Plessy case. You're absolutely right. Because, and as I said before, these things, that's why the court is so, so, so important. African-Americans, black folk, and Latinos and women have relied upon this court to sort of right the ship, to make the thing go right, and to bring some sort of equity, if not equality, to the situation. They can't rely upon this court to do that. And the problem is that we're stuck with this stuff for quite a while. We're stuck with it because this Congress is not, in the instance of the Voting Rights Act, going back anytime soon to change that. They can't even agree to cross the street on a green light. So you know they're not going to move on this anytime soon. We're stuck with it. It took us from 1896 to 1954 to overturn Plessy. And that took a great deal of struggle. And here you have the Voting Rights Act. Because one thing you want to always let folk know, you can still vote. That's not a problem. The thing is that obstacles are going to be put in your way to make that vote easier for you and to make it more inclusive of people.
The obstacles are put there to eliminate people who disagree with the power structure.
Yeah, with the power, what the structures are. And you bring up a good point, because the only way you're going to change this is to change the structures themselves. And that is a very difficult thing. If you begin to legislate and policy and create policy within the structure that are created by these folks, then you're not going to get very far. That's just who it is, because the structures are able to rebound and are resilient. They can absorb these things. And that's what the court is there for to do right now.
Well, Dr. Boone, I want to thank you for joining us this morning and giving us some insight on what's going on. And, you know, I thank you for being here. And as we move forward, hopefully folks will start to get mad and start to pay attention.
I hope you're right. In fact, I know you're right. I think it's going to take one more election, I think, when folks find out they cannot vote because their ID laws are set so stringent and so hard they cannot even exercise their rights as a citizen. And it's going to take a real movement on the part of people to do that.
I just never thought that the right to vote, that seems like such a basic American tenet.
It's a basic right. Although it's not mentioned as a right in the Constitution, it has come to be a right. And I would recommend that folk read Bader Ginsburg, Judge Ginsburg's dissenting decision, because I think at some point that's going to become the law.
Thank you so much, Dr. Boone. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Some claim the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County versus Holder provides Congress with an opportunity to extend the Voting Rights Act throughout the country, not just the 9 southern states. So far, response has come primarily from civil rights elders. Al Sharpton's National Action Network is calling for a march on Washington in August. Some in Congress are floating the idea of a John Lewis voting rights law, and the Senate will start hearings about the Voting Rights Act soon. But are we missing the widespread outrage here? Or do people just not care? If you're interested in fighting for voting rights in 2013, you can contact the National Action Network at nationalactionnetwork.net. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think about the Supreme Court decision? What do you think our leaders in Congress should do? Call us on the Local Take Community Hotline at 404-880-6211. I'm Kiplin Primus. Thanks for listening to the Local Take on WCLK.
You've been listening to Community Engagement on The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. The Local Take is a production of Jazz 91.9 WCLK Public Affairs. You can listen to this show on demand at our website at WCLK.com. If you have comments or suggestions for our program, please call us at 404-880-6211. The Local Take is produced by Kiplin Primus, Rob Maynard, and Marquis Lofton. Thanks for listening.